Good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are at the meeting at 1917 Walnut Street right now. Doors open at 10:30, meeting begins at 11. So we want to thank you for joining us in an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone for those who come to this meeting here. And during the pandemic, it has often been a comforting and joyful experience to Zoom to a meeting. It is important to recall the ULT Declaration. Philadelphia ULT meetings maintain anonymity, offer no crosstalk or side issues of personal anecdotes. Participants speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. These are traditions that are designed to welcome all to the study of the philosophy of theosophy without the distractions of any social differentiations or personal attributes. Let us all work to maintain these declared traditions. And the announcements will be given at this time.
We'll begin with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes, and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In keeping with the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, in Philadelphia we have a few weekly meetings. On Sunday morning, from 11 to 12, we have a formal presentation of the philosophy in the form of a panel, lecture, or forum. This month, we are entering a new theme, the science and art of communication. And today's program is called The Creative Potency of Sound and Speech. The doors open on Sunday at 10:30, and the meeting begins promptly at 11. In addition to our Sunday meeting, we also have a Wednesday evening study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. And we are, this Wednesday, April 6th, we are entering the chapter on cycles, specifically cycles, return of ancient civilization. And on Friday, well, before we get to that, we say that our meeting on Wednesday goes from 7:30 to 8:45. Our meeting on Friday afternoon goes from Friday afternoon evening goes from 6:30 to 7:30. It is a theosophy roundtable, an informal discussion on various aspects of the philosophy. Right now, we are using a series of articles by William Q. Judge. And for Friday, April 8th, we are going to be considering his article, The Authorship of the Secret Doctrine. As yet, we do not have library hours, although we do have a book table, which is available before and after the meeting on Sundays. But if you're not able to get references that way, there are a number of ways you can obtain the theosophical literature, and you can inquire at our website, ultphiladelphia@aol.com. All the activities of the Lodge are supported by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money, and all are greatly needed and appreciated. Okay. So this morning, as said, we are beginning our theme for the month, the science and art of communication. And this first Sunday, we are looking at the creative potency of sound and speech. Now we will have two short panel presentations. The first one will be on sound, and the second one will be on speech. And following those presentations, there will be plenty of time for questions and answers. So, beginning with the creative potency of sound. So, a first idea to realize is that sound is either beneficial or harmful, health-giving or toxic, soothing or agitating, inspiring or restricting, a blessing or a curse, so to speak. So sound is a creative cause of conditions, and the effect seems to correlate with the degree of substance that sound is working through. So it is correlated with the substance and therefore the nature of the being who is responding to it. So what would we say sound is as we experience it? Well, it's a pattern of vibration, sometimes called rates of vibration or frequencies of vibration. And these different patterns and frequencies of vibration influence, move, and mold the form of substances of nature according to the tone, the pitch, the rhythm in the case of music or sounds of nature, and also letters, vowels, and pronunciation in the case of speech. Now, in our next presentation, we'll go more into the potency of the spoken word. So we want to begin here, having with that general introduction, go into some examples of the creative potency of sound. Now, although late to the scientific field of inquiry, nevertheless, there is quite an amazing amount of research on the creative potency of sound in nature. We couldn't hope to exhaust it, but just to mention a few interesting examples. So we know of bird watchers, but part of the experience is bird listening as well, because each species of birds communicates with other members of the same species, particular to that species, by a series of identifiable tones. And experienced bird watchers can often hear and identify the birds in their environment much easier than they can by seeing the birds. So there are specific different sounds or series of sounds that birds make related to feeding activities, whether they feel safe, whether they feel there's alarm or threat, whether it's the mating season, or just if they're in a state of happy excitement. Now, it's interesting for those that look into this, sound waves, sound frequencies can accelerate growth and development in plants. For example, musical sounds produce better generation and germination of seeds. They actually produce cellular and metabolic changes in the plants, which facilitate their growth and development. Insects emit, just like plants, just like birds, insects emit species-specific sounds to help them escape unfavorable conditions or attract a mate. And we all know how important bees are to agriculture and pollination, but we hadn't realized that the specific frequency of the bees buzzing facilitates the release of pollen from the plant antlers and therefore facilitates pollination of flowers. We could certainly go on and on all morning about the many examples, but before we go into some other ideas, we also think it's worthwhile to consider the ancient knowledge of the potency of sounds. And many of us are familiar with this from the theosophical literature, but it is well known that the ancients had a clear understanding of the impact of sound. For example, the Chinese system of musical tones was originally a five-note scale, and each tone was related to a certain element of nature, and each tone had its peculiar effect on the nature of the human being, the psychological nature, the emotional nature, because of the vibrations, the frequency of rhythm and sounds. Theosophy goes on to say there's a whole hidden department of nature, which we might call the elementals, and they are semi-intelligent forces of nature, but they can be influenced by sound and color and their correlations. And of course, we know in India, there's the whole art and science of incantations or mantras. They recognize that sound being is one of the most potent magical agents. HPB tells us that sound may revive a dying person's may revive a dying person and give them renewed energy and vigor. And then she goes on to say that she's had personal experience because three times she was saved from death by the power of sound. In the Secret Doctrine, where we read of the various different kinds of creative potent forces in nature, one of the potent forces, of which there are many examples, are the so-called Mantrika Sakti from the Hindu tradition. And this is the force or power of letters, speech, or music, melody. And of course, we've all maybe seen movies or read stories of the fakirs of India, who possess a small flute called a yaguta. And the sound of this flute is well known to throw serpents or snakes into a cataleptic torpor, or charm the snakes into submission. And apparently in Egypt, even in more modern times, caravans will employ such talented musicians to ward off or control the snakes because they wouldn't want them to threaten the passengers in the caravan. So a physical sound made, what the point we're getting that here is that a physical sound made produces a vibration, but the effect of that sound goes well beyond into what we might call invisible realms. In other words, it can affect the psychic, mental, and spiritual departments of great nature, as well as human beings. And this is a whole study in itself. One other thing we wanted to mention, both ancient and modern physicians have well recognized the power of music and sound on healing diseases, especially nervous diseases. Aesculapius employed music in order to relieve severe cases of sciatica. He would blow on a trumpet for a sustained period of time, and the prolonged sound would have the effect of subduing pain. Mesmer also used a sound made from a series of five glass jars filled with different levels of liquid, a kind of harmonica, and by varying his tones, he would use this as an assistance in his magnetic cures. So it is well recognized, the magnetic potency of sound, and it will become more clear to us as we get into this subject of speech. But even from what we've talked about, we think we can draw some very practical lessons and conclusions. First of all, recognizing that sound can have a beneficial or harmful effect, we should be aware of the effects of sound and noise in our environment. Each nature responds differently, and some may find it very disturbing. And so there's this whole study of sound pollution and its effect on people's mental and physical health. But we should be aware and try to surround ourselves with sounds and musics that are conductive to the higher aspirations we have. And as this is on the science and art of communication, there's that old expression, it's not what you say, but how you say it. And sometimes the tone, the frequency, the rate of our speech is more influential in helping somebody and in communication than in the content of what you say. Finally, man, we have this expression over again that the human being is a microcosm of the macrocosm, a small copy of the universe. And on the larger universal scheme, the Greeks had a word, the logos, which when translated would mean the word or manifested sound of the invisible potency of divine thought and will, the manifestation in evolution of the hidden thought and will. How can we apply that very metaphysical idea in our own lives? Well, the effect of the sounds we make, even before getting into speech, the effect of the sounds we make, how potent they are in our communication, will have to do with what we might call our intention. In other words, the ideas, the aspirations, the motives that we have concentrated behind what we say, will make the utterances of our sounds, whether it's in speech or music, much more effective in the way we would want to use them. So right will, right thought, concentrated, right attitude, all these add to the potency of sound in our everyday use. So this would be a good point then to switch over to our second presentation, which will take a look at the potency, the creative potency of speech.
Good morning. As we were just reminded, there is a Hermetic saying, as above, so below. And all that you have just heard about the creative potency of sound also applies most especially to the speech used by soul experiencing the human state. Humankind is, after all, that microcosm of the macrocosm. The wisdom about the right use of speech abounds in the popular mind through all cultures across all times. Certain adages might come to mind. Silence is golden. Count to 10 before you speak. Hold your tongue. Certainly, no one could find ideal ethics in speaking with a forked tongue. And each of us probably knows the instinctive discomfort when we witness or hear bickering among or between an old married couple. It's discordant. It just isn't right, although it may be habitual and comfortable for them. Few are the common thinkers who pause to consider the marvelous science of the human evolution of speech. An idea or impulse must be generated. An image or meaningful symbol must be created and then interpreted into a word. Language and a range of vocabulary must be accessed in the mind. The vocal cords in the mouth need to create the sound vibrations for speech using the appropriate volume, tone, pitch, inflection, rhythm to convey just the right meaning to another. And all of that is accomplished instantaneously. The meaning to be conveyed is of the inner states of consciousness. Most frequently, the speech answers to what has just been heard, so the initial trigger for speech may be of the external physiological senses or not. The initial trigger may be of spiritual, soulful sensing of the need to speak. And there is even the silent, internal, self-talk speech as well. Let's consider the theosophical propositions about the source of this creative potency, speech, available to the human kingdom alone. It is true that certain physical traits were needed to acquire speech, the size and power of the brain, certain eye-hand-mind systems, the vocal cords, the organs of the physical mouth. And theosophy teaches that this physical apparatus was being developed in the first three rounds of this global manifestation. You can find that discussion in The Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, page 188 and forward. It is about 18 million years ago in the third root race of the fourth round that the lighting up of Manus is said to have happened. Three streams of evolution bloom together in the human state: spiritual, mental, physical. In this culmination, in this blooming of the three states, in the lighting up of mind, Manus, was born the ability to speak, the ability to use the mouth as a creative center of force in manifestation, to bring the symbols of soul language and soul wisdom into the world to be shared. Prior to that stage of evolution, we can imagine communication through telepathic means, through pantomime, sign language, body language, the guttural mimicry of the sounds of nature. And theosophy offers many avenues for each of us to study this. It is said that by the close of the Lemurian round, monosyllabic speech emerged. By the Atlantean period, the agglutinated speech emerged. And we can see, if we study the speech patterns and the languages of the Amerindians, we can find what's called fossilized traces of these developments. You can read about this in The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, page 199. Throughout a comparative study of culture and religion, a student can also explore the evolution of symbolism from early races who had an active third eye and natural clairaudience and clairvoyance to the current great race, gravely entrenched in the physical, the desire nature, and operating with limited mind powers. Too often, the current great race can be overpowered by the emotional and even the psychic natures. A student of theosophy can also look to comparative religions and cultures to study legends like the biblical legend of the Tower of Babel. We know that the premise was a universal one language to that tower, the babbling, the diversity, the miscommunication and confusion that ensued thereafter. But as students, we can look at the culture of the Sumerians, the Assyrians, the Greco-Romans, the Mexicans, the Amerindians, the Nepali, the Estonians, and the people of Botswana. Theosophy offers the truth that pre-Adamic universality of one language that preceded the amalgamation and confusion of our multiple tongues. The Senzar language is the universal manifestation of the original language of the soul, the wisdom of soul symbology. As we look around the world today, we would hope that things like sign language for the deaf, because it's a modern construct, would be universal, but it's not. Each nation, each language has a regional and national differentiation for their own sign language. So even in that modern arena where universality could have been achieved, it is not. A student can also look into the nature of sound and speech by using the analogy of speech acquisition among the babies of the human kingdom. And that analogy can verify the teachings of the earliest stages of human evolution. A typical human infant, a hearing human infant, first hears sound and tone, and even reacts in recognition to the voice of the mother upon birth. Why? Because that voice of the mother was heard in utero in the preceding months. Gradually, the toddler begins to mentally connect words, sound, with meaning, and to voice original ideas after many months of mimicry. But it is age 7 when most of the ancient folks say that the soul, manas, the full bloom of what it is to be a spiritual soul, is in full contact and connection with the physical and the astral. And so at that point, the full use of speech also begins to bloom. In this, we have the reflection of the wisdom of rounds and races. As was said earlier, in the kingdom of speech, there is much to study in the matter of sacred applied sound, in the eternal ethics of the use of speech, the truth of the creative potency of sound and speech. And it's in this avenue of study that each of us can find a blend of art and science, theosophy. Unregulated thought creates inaccurate speech and undisciplined action. The habits of mind and body are not merely the product of heredity and environment. Rather, as the soul creates and emits spiritual force, the very nerve centers of great nature are colored, magnetized, or otherwise impressed. Speech is the tool, the amazing mechanical tool that we use to do this. Memory works through the skandhas and the elements of nature, the elementals, to create a cyclic return of impress and habit. Memories generated by the lower mind are created by speech. Words are carriers of thought, will, feeling. Words are living things in metaphysical forms. The potency of words to harm or to heal is a powerful exertion of the true human, the eternal spiritual pilgrim. There's no mystery of the vibratory power of speech and sound. We've heard about it from the first panelist. Vibration affects every aspect of the environment around us, and unfortunately, it has been misused and abused. We're thinking of the use of sound as a torture and brainwashing device, well documented in times of war, in prisons, and even in certain fraternal initiations. We see the use of speech by dictators and other mesmerizers, certainly well documented in the mid-20th century, when masses of human beings were moved to unspeakable horrors. Theosophy explains that as vibration disturbs the atmosphere, creative and soulful vibration can awaken corresponding powers in the unseen as well. And here is the basis for those lovely colloquial adages we recalled at the beginning of our talk. So, what is a sincere student to do with the creative potency, the power of speech? Speech is an act. It is most difficult to control. So we start within. In The Secret Doctrine, Volume 2, page 490, you can find this advice. All our thoughts should be cogitative, having design and purpose. The power is in thought. The power is in the pause. Reflect on the timeless teachings and the laws of Manu, directing us on how to use speech. Let him say what is true, useful, pleasant, and never a disagreeable truth, never an agreeable falsehood. William Kwan Judge stated, "Let us use with care those living messengers called words." So we can guard the nature of the words and the music we hear and attend to. We can focus to listen to the spiritual message behind all the speech that we hear. We can avoid idle speech, thus avoiding the near temptation of gossip, slander, cant, hypocrisy. We can deliberate so as to create speech that carries the force of pure intention. We can select tone, volume, nuance, rhythm with great care for the effect on all others, from elementals to minerals to vegetables to animals to our fellow humans. We can read the words of devotional books aloud or silently to ourselves. We're thinking of the light of the path, the voice of the silence, the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada, and so many others. But read them with new eyes. There's much written on the right use of speech, avoiding obscene talk, personal talk, useless talk will remain a negative goodness unless or until there's an inner vow to do no harm, to uplift all in manifestation, to use speech to awaken the hearts of others to join the search for wisdom. And so we blend the heart and the head in gentle speech and the daily examination of our use of speech so that we can emit harmonious vibrations that bless, that heal, that harmonize. And then the twin doctrine to speaking is listening. That also is a portion of the creative potency of speech. In the Light on the Path, we are instructed that before the ear can hear, it must lose its sensitiveness. Before the voice can speak in the presence of the masters, it must lose the power to wound. And so the neophyte, the beginning seeker, the innocent student of theosophy, starts with the golden silence within, the nucleus of peace and universal brotherhood. That student practices silencing the senses and the call of feelings and desires. That student practices cogitation, reasons from eternal principles and propositions, and then creates the images, creates the symbols, creates the forces with which to people space with virtuous sounds, soulful speech. In Isis Unveiled, in volume 2, around pages 410, 411, the West was reminded that a curse, a blessing, a vow, a desire, an idle thought can assume a visible shape and become objective, become a manifestation. Every sound awakens a corresponding one in the invisible world of spirit, and the repercussion produces either good or bad effect. Right speech is one step toward eliminating all worldly evils. What words will we create this day? And what eternal life will we generate through our speech this day? Nothing dies. No idle thought or word that thou thinks or speaks is ever lost, but is forever cast into the duration of eternity. Now, we're willing to bet that you arrived this morning with plenty of thoughts on the subject matter yourself. ULT has a hand up, and then MDW.
Go ahead.
So where does the idea with writing, you know, writing a word, does that have anything? I mean, they're looked at as being symbols. So does this fit in with the idea of speech then?
The notion of writing is a very, very interesting one. What we did leave out of language acquisition, that after a child develops the ability to speak and to communicate through speech, they very gradually across time develop the ability to draw the symbols, to write them, and then to read them. So it's a continuum of communication. It's part of that art of communication, certainly. And it takes speech and the development of words that starts out invisibly in the mind through the process of being emitted in sound in the air, and then makes it even more tangible in manifestation. But what's interesting is that the written word can be lost. Books can be destroyed. Why else would certain dictators first burn libraries, but to destroy the record of the written word? We're assured in the study of theosophy that all thought, all spoken word is forevermore in the plane of consciousness that we call astral or Akashic reality. It's eternal, can't be burned. MDW, did you have your hand up? You're off screen right now. There you are.
Yes. It was stated that everything comes from a source, and the image was of a great breath, that everything is therefore a vibration. Everything is a vibration. So are you saying, or is it being said, that that's how we are gods, or can become gods, is through our speech? So our speech sort of indicates our thought. So it's said in theosophy that we are gods in potential. Is this our potential? Speech?
Is this our potential speech? Metaphysically, we've got all sorts of inspirational readings about the use of sound and speech, don't we? We have in the West, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the phrasing that God said, "Let there be light," and there was. Or in the beginning, there was word. And then, of course, in the Greco-Roman tradition, we have the notion of logos. Theosophically, we are taught from the Zenzar sources that desire first arose in it. Desire activates thought in the universal mind. Universal mind, therefore, has sound, symbol, ready to be emitted and to be manifested. This even follows us into popular culture. There is a very famous poem, a kind of an ode, entitled "Light of Asia" by Sir Edward Arnold. And in that poem, we do hear the echo of the wisdom that within there is the Buddhi or the Christos, the divine nature, the eternal nature of man. And so in the Light of Asia, we read, "Govern the lips as they are the palace doors, the king within. Tranquil and fair and courteous be all words which from that presence win." So our Father who art in heaven, the king within, however we come to this understanding of that divine creative force, that eternal self within, whether we think about it in the macro sense at the beginning of a deific unfolding of a Manvantara, or we think about it within the life of an incarnation, it's one and the same. I think there was a chat. Here's the chat. "Speech and sound are both wave frequencies, and all frequencies have a certain range. It is my understanding that the positive vibrations manifest at a range of 432 hertz. I recently learned that music was previously tuned at a range of 432, but has now been changed to a range of 440. It is in disharmony with natural frequency. Any thoughts on this matter?" And then also there's a question about chanting and the use of a mantra like the word Om. SL?
Oops. second here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Seem to have lost my visual, but you hear me. Great. Well, what do we mean by a natural frequency versus a man-made frequency? So all of nature, even plants, produce in their very action rates of vibration, frequencies. Pythagoras taught the idea of the music of the spheres, that even the operations and mysteries of the cosmos can be understood in terms of proportions of sounds and numbers and colors and music. Music was once defined as numbers or frequencies moving through time, and art, numbers and frequencies moving through space. So there is a natural frequency. But besides that, with knowledge, human beings can take what's a natural frequency and alter it to produce a particular effect, such as the idea of the mantras. And as we understand it, there is, depending on the effect of the mantra or effect of the vibration, will be the result of it. And even so, one could recite a mantra for years and years, but as was pointed out, without the appropriate thought and feeling, the ideas that the mantra represents, it's not going to have the desired effect that we want.
The other thing that comes to mind is the entire process of what we take for granted, this instantaneous creative process and potency of moving from volition or aspiration or desire quickly through symbology, through thought, into an outer manifestation. All of that necessitates that discerning cogitation, that discerning self-aware, self-devised control in the moment. So for one who sits in meditation, there's definitely theosophical advice that can be given. You could read Patanjali's yoga aphorisms. You certainly could do a wonderful search of the Theosophical Movement magazine on the Indian ULT website, or in the lodge, if you will, in Phoenix ULT. There's some articles reprinted on the role of sound in meditation. The last thing that's advised, the never to be done, is to create a passive trance, an abstentia, if you will, of mind in the moment, because of the hypnotic or mesmeric repetition of a mantra, a sound. It's just not to be done, and it creates a passivity. The sound is emitted, it goes through with force, but that passivity can sponge up activated elementals that we really don't want to be involved with ethically. There is another chat. Is rock music constructive or destructive sound? Boy, there's a question. And that question's been rattling around since the 1970s in the Theosophy Hall. there's a lot of research done with classical music, Western, symmetrical, harmonious, repetitive music that is soothing and peaceful. And it's that kind of music that you can play if you are having a bloom room in your home, or a gardening room where you're trying to sprout seeds. The plants do respond. We watch small babies and animals respond to that kind of music. And for many years in Theosophy Hall, we were advised that rock is discordant, that it has a whole different effect on the desire nature of human beings. And that study, the use of music of any kind, we can observe in pep rallies and halftime shows, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's an individual decision. And a very interesting parallel study is that the Western harmonics of classical music are not the same as the Eastern scale and harmonics. So perhaps it has to do with the scandic tendencies used by a soul coming into a particular incarnation. Does my partner have any observation on that?
Certainly, if we looked at the studies that we've seen, especially medically, when they look at the constructive value of music, they usually pick something classical, Mozart, Beethoven, to help with healing. And when it gets the idea of rock music, well, I guess it would depend on what kind of rock music. We know we have soft rock and metallic rock, and so it's not just the rhythm there, but the volume and any kind of music, even classical music, if it's played too loud, it's going to have a destructive effect on the ears, and even construction noise, if the individuals are not protected by it, has a destructive effect on the hearing. It can cause permanent hearing loss. So there's enough out there to realize that, you know, we have to be cautious about the kind of music we listen to.
And the whole notion of rhythm brought up another idea. If ever you have the experience of being in an MRI machine, as the magnets turn around the physical body, there's great clanking noise. It's a very powerful, huge sound that pulsates and beats physically on the body not through the ears, but the whole sensory tactile structure. So that's a very interesting experience. And even though folks may have headphones on, earplugs in, they may still be put into a kind of a trance state by the effect of the sound waves within that confined area. We have a query in ULT in Theosophy Hall. We've got a chat, and then we have MDW also. ULT, you're up first.
Go ahead.
It comes to mind that it's one thing as regards sound. It's one thing to think about the effect of music, but then to think about the effect of music to which words are applied. It probably kind of compounds the effect of the sound. And one small example we think of is when we watch a TV commercial, the company can put on a very, very boring, the words are very boring about what their product is, but if they put a jingle to it, it sticks with you and you remember that product much more than if they just talk about it.
It's true. Jingles are really, are something else. And we know there's been a lot of research on the use of sound, especially among indigenous people, where the physical environment of, say, Africa or some of the jungly regions of South America, the physical environment would destroy papyrus and other written sources, but nothing could destroy the potential of the human soul to use memory and sound to recite incredible amounts of history in a particular nation or tribe or village. It's really, really amazing how jingles and commercials, sound in indigenous culture, even learning processes. For most of us, probably, if somebody were to play a couple of notes or just a bar of music from something that we loved when we were young teenagers, we could immediately hum along the entire song and then gradually bring back the lyrics from memory as well. So sound alone as a melody, sound plus word symbology, is remarkably potent. And boy, don't those commercials on TV get loud. The volume jumps way above what the rest of the show was. There's a reason for that. There is a chat. Do you think that the frequency of rock music may make it harmful to the spirit? And that comes from someone, bless him, he's driving. I hope he's safe. Boy, that's a good question. The frequency of rock music, no doubt frequency, vibration, is key to all aspects of sound. And why would rock not be part of that pattern? SL, do you have something to add?
Well, we noticed that as we studied ancient religions, and that in a number of traditions, when someone became a serious disciple, they took what's called a vow of silence. Pythagoras, in the Pythagorean school, the initial students had to maintain a vow of silence for 7 years. They couldn't even ask a question, but had to think it over for themselves. So it sounds like like the spirit itself cannot be destroyed, but sound, even useless talk, especially talk or music or sound that agitates the emotional nature, by that agitation is going to obscure our access to our spiritual wisdom. It creates obstructions. And we've noticed this perhaps in moments where we've spoken very angrily about something. It has a disturbing, unsettling effect, whereas we might voice the same concern in a softer, gentler tone. It seems to help ourselves as well as the other individuals. And we see ULT has a hand up.
I think MDW was first and then ULT.
Okay.
MDW?
Yes. We were just wondering, one of the books that we are asked to study is called The Voice of the Silence. So even in meditation, aren't we to try to find that silence?
That sort of goes along with what just was said. The voice of the silence cannot be heard if our attention and our mind is taken up with the voices of our desires, our senses, the impressions of our senses and desires. So the voice of the silence is a state of meditation, attunement with our highest spiritual intuitions. Mm-hmm. So now that we have ULT,
Go ahead.
Yeah, we just wanted to make a quick comment that there have been a lot of videos lately where they're playing different kinds of music for animals and how they're reacting to it. Like they'll sway back and forth. Elephants will raise their tusks up and down, little, you know, cockatiels dance back and forth. So it's just really sweet. So it's, we can see how the vibrations can affect even the lower kingdoms.
And in the human kingdom, we can also see that if ever you get a chance to volunteer at a residential school for the deaf, there are student dances. There is loud music played, often with percussion instruments that are very rhythmic. And the deaf students dance because they sense the vibration in the air, not with their ears, not with the hearing, but they're reacting to the vibrations the same way that we see in all compartments of great nature. Our time is up. We're even over a little bit. But please, you're welcome to the next Zoom session of ULT Philadelphia. That would be Wednesday night. The meeting will start promptly at 7 o'clock, and the study is certainly going to be a good one, depending on all of us showing up and studying together. Have a wonderful day.